Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, as impeachment winds down, could criminal charges against Trump ramp up? The Democratic House managers have closed their case for convicting Donald Trump of inciting an insurrection. With video and audio clips, they recreated the events of January 6th and used the former president's own words to explain how the mob came to be at the Capitol that day. Republican senators continued to signal they planned to acquit. But even if Trump avoids conviction in the Senate, he could face accountability in a court of law. Harry Littman is legal affairs columnist for the Los Angeles Times and host of the podcast Talking Feds. We spoke Friday morning. Harry, we've just seen the House managers lay out their case against Donald Trump. How convincing was it as far as you're concerned?
I thought it was stellar. I mean, they're receiving generally high marks, and it's also true that they had a strong case, but I think it was even a stronger presentation than many people realize, because it was not just compelling in the basic narrative, but in many of the kinds of grace notes that you look for in a trial lawyer, it was admirably succinct. Prosecutors often drag on too long. It had a sort of through line of a theme that was able to both encompass the facts, the law, and these occasional leaps into, just occasional touches of leaps into more sort of soaring rhetoric to underscore the large stakes here. And there was something else. I thought Raskin, as sort of player coach here, made excellent use of his different managers. So there was a kind of dynamics that is hard to come by, except with a really stellar and accomplished trial team. He was the sort of umbrella figure, but others, Neguse, had this very comfortable kind of logical sense. Castro would sound these somewhat higher patriotic notes. All of them, I thought, were able to, in addition to everything else, provide a kind of dynamism to it so that it wasn't boring, notwithstanding some of the swipes by the Republican jurors. So I would say it was even better, I think, than it's being received, because having been in trial, I can have a sense of some of the things they did before coming out there that really succeeded.
Apparently, a lot of what they presented hinges on the interpretation of the word incitement. Define that for us and why that word is so crucial.
You know, Diane, I don't think that word is so crucial. And I think the people who are saying that are erecting an unnaturally high barrier for the managers, because they are trying to invoke certain legal doctrines that would be in play were he being charged with the crime of inciting. But really, it's what it sounds like here. It sounds like I think the best way to put it is the way Neguse did it. He lit the match. It doesn't have to be that they were reluctant participants, but he's the guy who exhorted them. He's the guy who made them think they were there to help. That is to instigate. There's nothing more complicated than that. If it were an instigation charge in the criminal courts, there'd be issues of First Amendment specific intent, none of which applies. And indeed, here, remember, this is a high crime and misdemeanor. Even if you posited, completely contrary to all the evidence, that his words just propelled them, that would be, I think, another fair synonym, to do what they did without his intending to. That would be enough. We're asking if he failed to take care that the law would be enforced. And if by his bumbling even, again, contrary to the evidence, he unleashed this force on the Capitol and this deadly, he impeded the Congress, etc. That would do the trick. We have to insist on both sides of the equation of the difference between the political exercise of an impeachment trial and a criminal trial as a whole different matter with all different protections.
So if this were a criminal trial, it would be totally different in terms of that word incitement. But in this case, because it's an impeachment, it's totally different.
Yeah, I would maybe hesitate a little on totally. The word is the word and the law is not an ass. But in a criminal trial, the judge would have an overlay of many constitutional doctrines, beyond a reasonable doubt, unanimity. Of course, in a real trial, the judge would be giving those instructions to an impartial jury that had sworn to actually put all preconceptions out of their mind. And very importantly, this is sort of the cornerstone of the jury system, one that would then proceed to a quiet room to try to reason together. That's never going to happen here. I think anyone who saw the trial would acknowledge the great force of it. And if they were in a room together, actually deliberating in good faith, things that they might raise, well, wait, is there a First Amendment defense? Or wait, didn't he say peacefully? They would talk through. This will never happen. And of course, the biggest departure from a genuine criminal trial is the complete the lack of impartiality among the jurors, which is pretty puzzling to me. I feel, you know, they have sworn an oath to do impartial justice, and it's a little mind-boggling how casual they are in renouncing it or acting in opposition to it. You have jurors meeting with defense lawyers. You have jurors announcing, I don't care what the court or what we ruled, I'm going to do what I want anyway. There is a law of the jungle out there in the sense that nobody can stop them, but it's really important to insist on the difference between that and what the rules and the law and the Constitution actually require them to do. So they're simply flagrantly departing from it, and it's a sort of sign of the times that they're doing it so casually and without apology.
You and I are talking on Friday morning before the defense begins its arguments. Yesterday, there were 15 empty seats on the Republican side. How can that be honoring the oath that they have taken to swear to be impartial jurors when they don't even show up?
Can you imagine? You know, of course, in a court, they'd be held in immediately, held in contempt, and, you know, potentially face sanctions. But, you know, the arrogance of it. So you're, of course, right. At one point, it was 17. As a sort of thought experiment, I imagined what Mitch McConnell might do if the positions were reversed, and he might, it would be, appropriate's too strong a word, but it would be certainly possible to jam through a motion to exclude them. They haven't heard. And, you know, and then, of course, the two-thirds requirement would dip to 56. But it's stunning. And again, it's so others who were there had their feet up on the desks. You had Lindsey Graham calling this offensive and absurd. Whatever this is, the idea that it's not weighty, grave of magnitude, the storming of the Capitol, the most sort of incandescent high crime and misdemeanor and dangerous one in our history, next maybe only to the Civil War. I think it feels to me like an error, maybe a grave error for them to be treating it with such contempt and so back of their hand. You would think it would suffice for even the most rabid base if they vote to acquit, and to everyone else, they seem, I think, like jerks. But they are experts at their own calculations of political self-interest, and Graham and others somehow believe that looking at, you know, there's a pearls before swine aspect here. It's beyond dispute that this is an excellent presentation of the most serious matter, and for them to treat it like a, you know, a third grade play by amateurs, it's really deeply disrespectful to the Constitution.
What about the argument that the defense will likely make regarding freedom of speech and the First Amendment as far as what Donald Trump said, and we have records of him saying exactly, you know, fight like hell, don't give up, you've got to go up there and keep this going. I mean, really.
Right. So just one quick prefatory note is one of the most effective parts of the presentation, I thought, was to sort of give us the lingua franca between Trump and the insurrectionists so that it was, they really explained, almost gave a kind of glossary how it was 100% clear, notwithstanding what he said. The First Amendment argument is a stone cold loser. There's not a First Amendment scholar in the country of any political stripe who would give it anything other than the back of the hand for many reasons. I'll just state a couple. Justice Holmes from in the late 19th century in a First Amendment claim by a public official, a police officer said, yo, he has a right to free speech, but he doesn't have a right to be a policeman. And of course, when Donald Trump became president, he took a superseding oath to take care that the laws be executed. And by the way, the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. Congress hasn't done anything here. The Constitution of the United States is what imposes the impeachment clause and the requirement. And if he so flagrantly violates it, including in speech, the idea that that would make him impervious in the same way as if he were a private citizen is fanciful. We're talking about, you know, it's an impeachment, stupid. It's just what I put in a column. I don't mean to be so dismissive, but it's simply a completely different set of rights and obligations. We're talking about whether the president has taken care, including in his speech. If he, as Representative Raskin said yesterday, you know, became a communist and went around quoting from Capital, God bless him as a private citizen, God impeach him as a president.
So the use of Trump's own language, his own words, the audio, the video, did that not make an impression? Could that not make an impression on those Republican senators? Could they sit there and simply dismiss that? I don't get it.
I mean, it is hard to get. Could it not make an impression? No, I agree with you. It had to make an impression. I mean, I think it made an impression on all of us. There were ways that the whole thing became so much more vivid, the sort of savagery. You know, it was like a medieval war there for hours of hand-to-hand combat. Totally deadly, completely understandable that people are cowering and calling their loved ones to say goodbye. And I thought it was very persuasive how they drew the whole through line from his initial, even pre-election protests that it was going to be stolen. And we were at the point, the very final seconds, where they couldn't do a political protest. What he was exhorting them to do was physically impede the vote that was going on right then. So I think it can't help but make an impression, but it's on any impartial juror, and even on a partial juror as they are. But I think it is a bit of a puzzle that they think they don't even have to pretend to be open-minded about it. That had been the appeal of this jurisdiction argument. You know, they could pretend to be open-minded and say, well, we just don't have the power. On the First Amendment, you can't really do that. And I also have to say, I repeat that, one thing that Ted Cruz can do is assess his political self-interest better than I can. But I don't get it. There's, we had this morning Nikki Haley parting company. One of them is right and one of them is wrong. It sure seems to me that this is their golden opportunity to disable a man that they all loathe and who tyrannizes them with the threat of a primary challenge and the like. And why they wouldn't want to weaken him is, just from the standpoint of their political self-interest, is puzzling to me. But in any event, I feel that they certainly understand how strong the case is.
How do you answer that? What is so puzzling? How do you answer the question of why they are so afraid to stand up and be counted honorably?
Yeah. It's hard. I think there's we're now assuming the most base, cynical, self-interested motives, which is already a panoply of problems. These are senators in a moment of great national magnitude having sworn to do impartial justice. But let's go into a completely Machiavellian world. To me, there's a kind of collective action problem here. If they would all sort of get together and stand strong and get to 17, they could do it. But the first person who stands up fears that it won't succeed and they'll have a kind of Liz Cheney problem. And do credit Trump with this one remaining power. I don't think of deciding who's the candidate, deciding who wins, but being able to call out a primary challenger. Can he really do that now? Will it not be the case after this impeachment that his power will have winnowed down? I mean, if you're part of the 70 million and you've seen this most savage face of the real core, are you not repelled, and does that not weaken his overall power? But they are persuaded, I think, because they're willing to be mendacious in public and to violate their oaths, that he can kill them and one by one, or really seriously challenge them in a primary in 2022. And again, that's the only thing they're thinking about is really quite an indictment of themselves. But that's my best guess. Nikki Haley obviously thinks differently. And there's a world here in which, 2-4 years from now, he's a footnote. But they don't calculate that way, and including people who we know hate his guts, right? Like Senator Cruz.
Talk about what Nikki Haley had to say.
Yeah, she said, and boy, that this is a lot of crow to swallow, because at a few different junctures in the administration, she really came in strong and put her own fairly glittering image on the line. She didn't only say that this was wrong and we now have to part company. She said, it was a mistake to have followed him. I admit it. We had it wrong. We were blinded or whatever. This is such a vivid illustration of his evil, corrupt side that, it's just in whatever else he might do in taxes or judges or whatever Republicans would like, just is swamped by the damage to constitutional norms. It's the right argument, and it positions her to be free of Trump, and we'll see. I frankly doubt that he'll have the power to, bring her down next time she runs. Of course, that will probably be for president as opposed to senator, but really telling that she said, we made a mistake all these 5 years.
The question becomes, do Nikki Haley's words change any minds?
Yeah. And I'll align her with someone else who seems open to it and may be very influential, Mitch McConnell. He has continually given himself room to vote to convict on the merits, which would be the definitive staking out for the Republican Party. He cannot want, none of them can want, the Republican Party to continue to be purely Trumpist, except the handful like Johnson who are really Trumpist themselves. They have to dearly wish it. So he could take this as the opportunity to stake out a saner Republican Party. If he does, would there not be 5, 6, 7 who might follow him? I think so. And we already had the most bipartisan impeachment. You know, people are making a big deal of partisanship, but Andrew Johnson's impeachment never gained a vote on the other side. Bill Clinton's on the other side. So this is already, by our standards, which are very different, by the way, from what the framers thought it would be, it's already pretty bipartisan. I think there's a reasonable chance, you know, I think on the Vegas odds board, there's a 3-to-1 or something chance that McConnell defects and that even 5 or 6 go with him. But that still makes a pretty giant leap to get to 67. On the other hand, I think people understand that this isn't simply being fought in the Senate. It's being fought in the country. You know, Raskin says senators, America, and also around the world, and finally in history. So a movement like that from McConnell and another half dozen, I think, given the historical context, would really seal it in concrete that he had done this most wicked and pernicious of things. And that itself is weakening, even if it means he could still run for office.
Do you believe that McConnell saying that each senator should be free to vote his or her conscience is an indication of anything other than precisely those words?
Probably. So even those words are significant because he's giving them some cover in the public sphere, but I don't have much doubt. He may, in fact, still be calculating. But Mitch McConnell, you know, once 10 times burned, 11 times shy, I do think he is deciding what the party should do, and he will issue sub silentio commands, even if that's the open party line. But again, it makes it easier for, you know, Mitt Romney has an easy ride, but the other 4 or 5 who are going that way have somewhat greater cover. I don't think, though, that in a moment of this magnitude, McConnell would simply be, you know, indifferent and tell them all to do really just what they want.
What about Susan Collins?
So, you know, she's in an interesting position, different from last time, because she has 6 years. She's not facing the electoral pressures. Now, you would think that would push in favor of an honest judgment on the merits. You think of her as certainly not. You know, the charges against her are maybe a kind of political cravenness, but not a kind of wild-eyed Trumpism. So I think at the end of the day, she's a pretty good bet. Let's put it this way. If she, for any reason, were voting to acquit, it would be a sign that it's, you know, a dead letter.
A dead letter. Do you believe that racism and white supremacy is playing a role in all of this?
Yeah. So what a tough and indicting question. So obviously, on one level, it is in the story. You know, one of the most harrowing aspects of the trial, we had seen little snippets on the evening news, but they very expertly just put it in our face, and the insurrectionists were all in the officers and everyone's face. You know, they were inches away and spitting and screaming and cursing, and those were clearly the faces of angry white men, and to a somewhat, you know, much lesser extent, angry white women. But that dynamic is, you know, white as can be, and that means that to go back to the puzzle you and I just discussed about why are Republicans doing it, at some level, the engine here that's driving it is the power of this real last concentric circle of Trump's base. They fear that he can lift his finger and call them into action and harm them politically, or in this case, even storm the Congress. That base is white. There's no way around it. It's the you know, white, non-educated, mostly male base. So in that sense, the national phenomenon that they're all bowing to very much has racist overtones. We'll also see some racist overtones today, because we can expect the former president's lawyers to be talking about Black Lives Matter and other protests. And of course, it's a complete non sequitur to the extent, and it's much, much, much less, but to the extent there was violence at those demonstrations, the law should respond forcefully. But the difference between private citizens either protesting peacefully or getting out of hand, and the president of the United States inciting an insurrection on the Congress in the service of a lie to prevent the peaceful transfer of power, it's completely inapposite, but that will have certain racial overtones as well. I wouldn't, without more proof, say that the lack of open-mindedness, the fundamental corruption, I think is not too strong a word, of senators who are violating their oaths and not keeping an open mind is tinged with racism, but the story is.
More of my conversation with Harry Littman when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Harry Littman. He is a former U.S. attorney and deputy assistant attorney general. He now writes the legal affairs column at the Los Angeles Times. So the House managers seem to believe that this threat is not in the past, that if Donald Trump is not convicted, the threat is ongoing. The threat may be ongoing whether he's convicted or not. But that was a point that was made. Do you believe that to be true?
Yeah, this is a great question, because the short answer is I do believe it to be true. You know, Adam Schiff said something similar in his final exhortation to those senators. It's certainly completely sufficient to bring and convict because of what he did, and to respond to it and say, and have America say, this is not who we are. Certainly Andrew Johnson or Richard Nixon, they were finished politically, and that wasn't the point. But Ted Lieu, one of the most memorable lines from yesterday is, I'm scared he's going to lose, and what will he do then? I mean, look, this was a stunning criminal offense to storm the Congress, and it happened because he was at his rope's end. He had tried everything lawful to keep this from happening, and then it was the very moment when Congress was going to certify the votes, and at that point, there was basically nothing he wouldn't do to avoid losing if he could, which we know is anathema to him. So if you imagine a world where he stays active or is a candidate and it's going awry, let me put it this way. What would stop him? Why wouldn't he? And the normal answer would be some modicum of conscience or norms or worry about one's place in history. He's really shown vividly for 4 years, but definitely on January 6th, that next to forestalling a loss, that doesn't register with a guy like him. So, you know, it really does seem plausible to me, if he stays in the hunt, if he runs for president, if as one hope would happen, the country rejects him, but he has any dirty trick, criminal or not, to pull to try to stay alive. Yeah, I think he could really do it.
The opening arguments of his defense team were largely panned. People, and perhaps Trump himself, thought they did a terrible job. Do they have to do any better now, today, tomorrow, in order to bring this to a satisfactory close for Donald Trump?
If satisfactory close means acquittal, they don't. It's really something. I mean, there's a kind of theater of the absurd quality here where you have the irresistible case. It's a very, very strong case, meeting the unmovable force of jurors who would, you know, any port in a storm they'll take. Look, they did a terrible job. There's no way. I mean, they did almost a puzzlingly terrible job. Somebody said something, you know, this was like the paralegal pushed up there because the real lawyer is stuck in the taxi because it was so rambling and unsubstantive. But they've only been there a week. And the truth is, they have a very weak case. And the more they kind of push on, we'll see it today. They will try to push, say, on the First Amendment arguments. But that will serve the purpose of sort of highlighting the strength, I think, of the manager's case. So that's why they want to be very short. They have 16 hours, and they're only going to take three. And this is after a case that everybody throughout the political spectrum acknowledges is extremely strong. So that is their difficulty. But yes, you know, he couldn't get a top flight lawyer. And the main one that he has found is a solo practitioner defense lawyer. And, I've been in court with a number of those. And when they have rough cases, as they often do, there's a sort of, you know, one trick in the playbook of just kind of putting the government on trial and just, you know, generally trying to make snide asides and that sort of thing. It was very ineffective in their opening, and surely they'll do better, especially with the coaching of some of the jurors like Ted Cruz yesterday. But nevertheless, I just don't think it's possible to be very persuasive in their case. Nevertheless, they have the whole card of all whole cards. They have a corrupt jury, you know, that's in the tank for them. You know, they will nevertheless cruise. But again, there are other juries out there, the American people, the world, and history, and their poor performance here will highlight the strength of the manager's case.
So what is going to be the heart of their argument?
It's stunning to me, Diane, but the reports in the paper are the First Amendment. It's hard to describe the complete unanimity. Nobody, no scholar of any stripe would say that it is anything other than garbage. I was sort of surprised. Raskin played this gambit, and it maybe has succeeded. They are duty-bound now. The Senate has decided the jurisdiction argument is rejected. Raskin said that. And I thought, strong gambit, will it play? Because Senator Blunt, for example, said yesterday, I don't have to go along just because 56 senators say so. Well, that's exactly what you have to do. Those are the rules of the game. But I had still thought that they would try to count on that, even though it's a pretty delicate position to get up and say, oh, I know you guys decided as a body, but all you other people just ignore it. At least gave them cover of some vaguely plausible argument. The First Amendment is, you know, a tissue thin joke. And if that's where they hang their hat, you know, again, the legal community, the broader community, the historical community cannot but snicker that that's the best they could come up with in a proceedings of this gravity.
You talked earlier about the jury of the public and indeed the world. There's been a lot written about how the world is seeing us now. What's your take?
You know, I happen to have done a lot of, like, at least, well, both European and a little bit of Asian TV. I think it depends on where in the world. I think on the 6th, the people who think America is high-handed were sort of, you know, guffawing that here we were having these kind of third world problems, and Europe was completely, you know, consternated. What the hell is happening to America? So I think they are following closely, and to the extent an objective observer would see this as a very strong case, and I think they do. You know, I think they're reassured or buoyed that, you know, America at least is projecting to the world what's wrong and what's happened. But I think for people who haven't encountered impeachment before, the notion that we're now inured to after the last impeachment trial, that the jurors here can just pronounce an empty oath and disregard it. I've had questions from anchors in, you know, abroad, like, but I don't understand. They've sworn to, how can they not be present? And it really is, I know it's just a metaphor, a trial here, although it is the word in the Constitution. But if you're even excising the aspect of doing impartial justice, then what's left? Then it's just theater. So I think right now there is a sense of, okay, we're seeing the sane face of America reassert itself, and that maybe dovetails with their relief at the change in administration. But come Saturday, as soon as tomorrow, when the verdict comes in, I think there will be the same sort of either celebration or confusion. But let me make one point, and maybe you were going to get to this anyway. I do think, you know, unlike the last time around, people, you know, it was foreign policy for starters, which makes Americans' heads spin. But when the impeachment trial ended, we closed the book on the Ukraine. That was the end of the whole episode. Not so here. We have hundreds of people being investigated. They are going to go to trial. They are going to make the defense that I was obeying my president. They are going to subpoena the president, a private citizen, to show up. Maybe courts will even permit it. The Department of Justice, and this is not a happy event, I think, for Merrick Garland, but they're going to have to seriously investigate Donald Trump, Donald Trump Jr., Rudy Giuliani, and then there are state prosecutions, including ones based on this very scenario in Georgia about the strong arming of the Secretary of State completely illegitimately, and New York. And I do think it shouldn't be this way, right? I mean, justice should be, you should assess everything on the facts, but if he walks away in a way that's portrayed as a victory, I do think that will give a little bit of strength in the step of the other prosecutors who are looking at him. An overall sense, at least in the nation, that justice wasn't really done. Or put it conversely, were he to be convicted at this trial, which seems completely unlikely, there might be a national consensus of enough and a sort of abeyance of these other actions against him. So I think there could be a subtle kind of rebound effect. And of course, from the question you posed at the beginning, the response of the world, et cetera, you know, were Donald Trump to be criminally prosecuted? And by the way, it's not the right response to the, I mean, I've said again and again, it's got to be the impeachment. For this abuse of official power, that's the response we want. Nevertheless, if it winds up that a president, a former president of the United States, is put in jail, that will certainly play to foreign ears as a, you know, complete national rebuke of the Trump years.
Do you believe that the House managers erred in not calling witnesses?
Yeah. So it's a terrific question. The short answer is no, I think they didn't. I think they were basically unerring. I think they were able to effectively put in everything with one major exception. To me, after the video, the most vivid probative evidence is those 6 hours where if someone had had been surprised that his supporters were all of a sudden storming the Capitol, of course he would have rushed to reverse it. And we know that he didn't. We knew that already. We knew that even 6 hours later, he said, "This day shall live in glory, go and be proud." But this, I think, extremely inculpatory evidence is the fact that he was reported as being delighted. And even more, this is like an exquisite little sociopathic touch. He was confused. Why weren't other people delighted? He literally couldn't understand why people weren't celebrating with him as he saw people storming the Congress and endangering the lives of all the representatives. That is killer evidence. That's the sort of thing, if I were a prosecutor, I would be closing with my last sort of 5 or 10 minutes. To have presented that through a witness would have been really vivid, but the cost would have been that, you know, you had the Republicans rattling sabers and saying it's a Pandora's box. I'm not sure what witnesses they could even have proffered here, but it would have prolonged things, made things more messy. So there's that tiny little piece that hopefully the jurors, the senators, will take as established that he was delighted, that he was surprised that others weren't. That would have been very, I think, compelling if it came through the lips of a witness who was there. But I think the cost, I think they very reasonably made a calculation that the cost would have been too great. And just generally speaking, as I've said, I think their overall sort of trial tactic set of calculations was damn near impeccable.
If indeed he is acquitted, what about censure?
So, I mean, my view has been, this is just mine, that this really is too serious for censure. I mean, I think censure plays as, you know, sort of a stern rap on the knuckles. And this is a guy who called out criminals, terrorists, to storm the physical center of the government to attack the, you know, the ideological centerpiece of the government, the peaceful transfer of power. I think he stands censured in history, but for that to be the official response, it's just not condign. It's, I would rather see, you know, 56 vote to convict than 100 vote to censure. It's so obviously won and compromised, and this is so obviously a situation in which a compromised response is too weak, is inappropriate.
What a terrible time.
Yeah, I mean, really, you, I know we're, you know, this is sort of obvious, but watching the video and the, you know, is this America, that officer who sat down after being called, you know, the N-word and hit for, and just looking up, is this America? The vividness of the episode, the raw kind of corruption of it, is, it's really, you know, harrowing and depressing to, you know, just take a step back. And that's that video now, and how it has been packaged. That's like the Zapruder film now. That's a part of living history and not a happy part.
Harry, thank you.
Diane, such a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for asking me.
That was Harry Litman. He is legal affairs columnist for the Los Angeles Times, teaches constitutional law at UCLA and UCSD. He's the host of the podcast Talking Feds. And that's all for today. Thanks to those of you who've written to let us know what's on your mind. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Steve Lack. Thanks for listening. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.